This message is provided by Bridgeway Community Church. Thanks for tuning in.
Well, good morning, Bridgeway. I'll add my words of welcome, and it's just so good to be here together with you. Welcome you here in person, as well as say hello to those of you who are online, church at home. It's just good to be together. And if you're just joining us, I really felt God call us this year to begin 2022 by looking at the ups and downs and the highs and lows, or as I'm calling them, the peaks and valleys that we go through in life. And I've gone through some valleys in my life. I didn't know that when I started this series, I would enter into a valley, but I've gone through some valleys. I know you have as well, and this isn't at all intended to be like a pity party or group share, but I really hoped that this series would allow us to have a framework of how we handle life's most extremes, the moments when we're kind of at the top of our game and then the moments where we feel really low. In fact, if you were here last week, we looked at one of those moments. We looked at the story of young Jonathan. He's a prince. He's a warrior. And I can't get that story out of my head. I love that moment where Jonathan goes against all the odds and he faces all the uncertainty and yet still presses through to achieve the goal that God had called him to. And just such a moment. It's the athlete who hits the game-winning shot or the final drive into the end zone. And I love those moments. And I would love this morning to stay on the mountaintop with you, but I kind of feel like God wants us to, for the next few weeks, enter into the valley. Should we enter into the valley together? Some of you are like, Pastor, that's a terrible idea. Why would we have that conversation? And yet, that seems to me exactly the way life works. It seems like there's way more of these moments where we're kind of in the valley and we have to learn in those moments, how do we deal with discouragement and disappointment and struggles and issues? And I think the church is the place where we need to talk about those moments the most. In fact, one of my favorite verses is Psalm 23. I love Psalm 23, and it kind of gets a bad rap because Psalm 23 usually gets read at funerals. And yet it's this beautiful picture, right? It's this idea that the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. You get this image in your mind. I don't know what it looks like to you, but I see mountains and rivers and God's creation, and I see God caring for me as part of his creation. But then there's that one line in the psalm, right? There's that line that no one likes to really read, and that's why it gets read at funerals. And it's the line that goes, you know, even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. And it's those valleys that we don't often know how to navigate. I've said in the series that I think that the mountaintops are so rare because every mountaintop seems like we've got to navigate two valleys, one on either side of it, and that's exactly how life works. And I want to walk through those valleys, and I want us to be the type of church where not just me, but as a community, we're equipped and we're not unprepared to walk through the valleys that each of us in our own lives and our friends and our family around us we'll go through. I get kind of frustrated, if I'm honest with you, because I feel like when I see the church today, I see many churches around us, they don't want to talk about some of these harder, more valley moments. In fact, it's rare that you ever hear messages on things that are near and dear to my heart, like mental health. And it just seems like this should be the place where we are most ready and most prepared to enter into topics of anxiety and darkness, and depression, and suicide. And I want this church to be a place where it's okay when life's not okay, and that we're okay as a church to talk about that. I think sometimes the church can be the place where people come to and they feel like they have to pretend. They feel like they come to church and they kind of put on the good Christian image and they say things that they never say outside the church. They say things like, well, I'm good. Me and God are good. And you know, the Lord is my strength. And they may even say truth, but deep down they're struggling and they're hurting. And we need to be the kind of place that is prepared to help each other through those moments. So I kind of think about how sometimes it's hard to navigate those moments and you think, I don't want to enter into their story or their hurt or their pain. And yet that's exactly what God's calling us into. And maybe outside of that, it can feel sometimes like when someone doesn't want to talk to you. Or like when someone doesn't want to call you back or even just respond to a text, right? They kind of blow you off. In fact, This probably has nothing to do with my sermon, but someone sent me this, and I thought we needed a little laughter this morning. So they sent me this. If cats could text you back, they wouldn't. A lot of truth there, right? It's not wrong, right? Like a lot of truth there. And I don't know, I had to show that. And maybe the point about that for this message today is we want to be the type of church that we do far more than just text each other back. We enter into and we engage in those challenging moments. I want to deal with really maybe the most difficult theological question that really exists, and it's this question. It's, why does God allow people to suffer? This is really the question or the problem of evil. And I'm really talking about innocent suffering, because this is the kind of question that comes up, whether you're in a conversation with a bunch of Christians or people who don't know God. Eventually, this question is going to come up, and it's the question of why do bad things happen to good people, right? Innocent suffering. I mean, nobody really cares when bad things happen to bad people. We say things like, well, they had it coming to them. But when someone's innocent and they suffer, when a child is harmed, when someone who's really good or has a great life, even someone who's following God with their life, if something bad happens to them, it's devastating. We come unhinged. Why, God? Why? And this is the number one reason people kind of push God away and out of their life. Why would God allow that? And the rationale will work something like this. Like, well, either God isn't really all that good, because if God was really good, he wouldn't allow, you know, cancer and car accidents and disasters and COVID, right? Either God isn't all that good, or your God isn't really all that powerful. I mean, right, if God was all powerful, then he would prevent those things from happening. He would protect people. He would at least protect Christians, right? And that narrative gets played out, and it forces people to have to choose. So the question for us here today, maybe another way to think about it is, how do I stick with God when life's not okay? When things are scary or disappointing, or I'm angry, or I'm in a valley? And I got to be really honest with you. I don't want to come up here today and offer you some simple pat answers, you know, three ways to a new and better you, right? Like, that is not my goal. In fact, I really want to enter into the problem of suffering. And I want you to see, maybe this morning, a different view of how God views our suffering and the truth that he offers to us. And so I thought it would be good to enter into a story, an ancient story. And so I want to look at the story and the life of Job. If you have a Bible, I'd love for you to turn to Job chapter 1. If you've never read Job, I'd really encourage you to read it. Maybe this afternoon. There's no football on until later this afternoon. You got plenty of time. You can read the book of Job. Or I used to call it when I was a kid, I called it the book of Job. Like, I didn't know how to pronounce it, and I didn't have the little nursery rhyme to get the books in my head. And so I remember saying to my mom, I'm going to read the book of Job. And she carefully told me it's the book of Job. So it's Job, and it's a really, really long book. It's 42 chapters. And I'll just tell you, there's a stretch in this book when you read it that gets boring. Did your pastor just say that the Bible was boring? I did. In fact, I think it's okay to say that, and it's actually, I think part of how this idea of suffering hits us, we think that life needs to keep moving and be so dynamic and quickly. And again, what did I say? We have to walk through these valleys. And there's a stretch in the book of Job that's just long and drawn out. It's dialogue and narrative back and forth. And it begins to paint for us how suffering works. Suffering is long and hard to deal with in life. And this is the oldest book in the Bible. And so it kind of tells us that suffering has been there since the beginning. It's kind of woven into the fabric of our lives. But I saw something different in the text this week that just kind of blew me away. In fact, I'll try to give you a new framework for the book of Job, especially if you've read it before. And I'll try to explain it this way. Have you seen the new Spider-Man? Just by show of hands, has anyone seen the new Spider-Man? A lot of you have seen, not all of you, some of you have seen the new Spider-Man, right? The book of Job is kind of a story on two verses. It's a story on two planes. It's a story on two stages, right? I mean, the crazy thing about the Spider-Man movie, and this whole idea is it's got this multiple universe, the multiverse, right? These alternative universes. In fact, if the word verse is new to you, kind of get used to it because it's here to stay. Facebook is now metaverse, and now Marvel Comics has picked up on this whole idea of, hey, we don't even have to follow. I told my kids, I said, what makes the whole Marvel storyline work is Marvel's like broken the rules. They don't even think that it's like normal. They don't even think that they have to follow some sort of chronology. They can just make up storylines and just say it's from another universe. And you've got a story like Spider-Man, three different types of Spider-Mans. I'm ruining the story for you, but spoiler alert, right? It's just fascinating. And in some ways, this story of Job is like that. It's a story on two verses. You're going to see in the first scene, you're going to see Job here on earth, and you're going to see his life, and then the scene is going to shift, and you're going to see a view into heaven and a conversation between God and Satan. Job chapter 1, we'll read a little bit and then teach a little bit. Job 1, starting in verse 1. In the land of Uz, there lived a man whose name was Job. This man was blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters, and he owned 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 donkeys, and had a large number of servants. He was the greatest man among all his people of the East. His sons used to hold feasts in their homes on their birthdays, and they would invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. When a period of feasting had run its course, Job would make arrangements for them to be purified. Early in the morning, he would sacrifice a burnt offering for each of them, thinking, "Perhaps my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." This was Job's regular custom. Now, we're talking about suffering today, and there's no suffering in these opening lines of Job. In fact, Job is on a peak, isn't he? I mean, Job is experiencing kind of this goodness of life, and you can notice a lot of things about Job. First of all, did you notice where Job lived? It says he lives in the land of Uz. Now, you could get out your phone right now, open up Google Maps, try to find Uz for me. You won't find it. In fact, I already told you that Job is this ancient story. It's so ancient that scholars are really mixed on exactly where Uz is. And all we kind of get clues of is if this is the oldest book, then we have to kind of relate this to Adam and Eve in the garden. And when Adam and Eve were in the garden, they had this perfect union with God, but then they broke God's heart and they sinned against him. And what happens in that moment then? God takes Adam and Eve, his creation, and he places them outside of the perfect goodness of the garden. He places them outside of the garden to the east. And life kind of begins for humanity outside of God's blessing. It begins outside of the garden. It begins in the east. And we have to assume Job is kind of part of that legacy that lived to the east of Eden. In fact, the text tells you that he was the greatest among his people in the east. Maybe another way to think about the land of Uz, or being east of Eden, is it's a place where humanity is trying to figure out their existence in this way in which they've sinned and they've broken the heart of God. East of Eden is a place where lives are really broken. But Job is this man. He's a man of integrity. He's blameless. He's upright. He's fearing God and shunning evil. He's a great man. He's also a very wealthy man. I mean, Job, it says, is the greatest. Another translation of that word is the word richest. Job had money. He had sheep and camels and oxen and donkeys. How many donkeys do you have? Do you keep track how many donkeys you have, right? We don't really count wealth that way, but they did in that day. Now you would say maybe Job is the type of man that, I don't know, he's got a beach house in Malibu, and he's got 2 Teslas plugged in, and he's got a vacation home in the Barbados. That's kind of who Job is. And he's a family man. He's got 7 sons and 3 daughters, and he's raising them to know and to follow God. We're going to get to Mrs. Job in just a moment, but we see that Job is this man after God's own heart. He's a worshiper of God. In fact, it's kind of hard to see it in the text, but it says it was his regular custom to come before God and to bring an offering. He would take one of his sheep or maybe one of his ox, and he would sacrifice them and lay them before the altar and burn them before God. And he didn't just do this for himself. Did you catch that in the text? Said that he would do this for who? For his children. And all we really get about the children is it seems like they're they're having this feasting and this drinking, and then Job offers this commentary. Perhaps they have sinned, right? Like, you think? You know, perhaps. And we see that Job is kind of this typography. He's almost a Christ-like figure, right? He's offering this gift on behalf of those who may have sinned. Job has this wonderful life. It's all peaks. He and God are good, but a valley is coming. Picking back up in verse 6, we read this. One day the angels came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came with them. The Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Satan answered the Lord, "From roaming throughout the earth, going back and forth on it." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil." "Does Job fear God for nothing?" Satan replied. "Have you not put a hedge around him and his household and everything he has? You have blessed the work of his hands so that his flocks and herds are spread throughout the land. But now stretch out your hand and strike everything he has, and he will surely curse you to your face." The Lord said to Satan, "Very well then, everything he has is in your power. But on the man himself, do not lay a finger." Then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. Did you notice the scene kind of change there? Now we've got this very different verse, right? We get this view into heaven, and it's angels and demons and a conversation between God and Satan. And it's all incredibly fascinating, unless, of course, you're one person, unless, of course, you're the topic of conversation, Job. I mean, can we just be honest for a moment? This is bizarre, right? I mean, the whole conversation, the whole way in which we see that evil, Satan says he's been roaming the earth. It's this dissonance, this presence of evil everywhere. And God kind of offers up Job, right? "Have you considered my servant Job?" And, of course, you know, this raises all these questions. I think down here in this verse, we ask questions like, why does God allow evil and suffering? But do you notice that that's not even the conversation that they're having in heaven? I mean, the conversation is very different. It's, "Have you considered my servant Job?" And God knows Job. Job is upright. He's righteous. He's a follower. He's this man that shuns evil. And of course, Satan turns the table, right? He says, "Well, that's just because you've blessed him. I mean, he's blameless and upright only because of your protection." The real question in heaven is not, why does God allow suffering? The real question in heaven is, does Job really fear God for nothing? Like, is there some sort of arrangement? I mean, God, you're just blessing his life, and if you remove your blessing, oh, you better believe that Job will curse you. Job will leave you. Job won't want anything to do with you. And there really in lies the question of, in the face of suffering, where do we go, and who do we stick with? And so there's this deal, this test, right? I mean, God says everything he has is in your hands, but on the man himself, do not lay a finger. And then the scene is going to shift one more time. We're going to read through the end of this chapter because devastation and disaster is coming. Verse 13, it says, "One day when Job's sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house, a messenger came to Job and said, 'The oxen were plowing and the donkeys were grazing nearby, and the Sabaeans attacked and made off with them. They put the servants to the sword, and I am the only one who's escaped to tell you.' While he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, 'The fire of God fell from the heavens and burned up the sheep and the servants, and I am the only one who escaped to tell you.' While he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, 'The Chaldeans formed three raiding parties and swept down on your camels and made off with them. They put the servants to the sword, and I am the only one who's escaped to tell you.' While he was still speaking, yet another messenger came and said, 'Your sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house when suddenly a mighty wind swept in from the desert and struck the four corners of the house. It collapsed on them, and they are dead. And I am the only one who's escaped to tell you.'" Now here's Job's response. "At this, Job got up and tore his robe and shaved his head, and then he fell to the ground in worship and said, 'Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will depart. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised.' In all of this, Job did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing. I mean, can you imagine this moment? I mean, we often talk about suffering as kind of coming in waves, right? We kind of receive suffering, and it seems to just kind of keep rolling in waves, and you see these waves for Job. I mean, can you imagine? I mean, there's this first wave, and it's an enemy, and it says that the Sabaeans came, and they killed all the hired hands, and they took all the oxen, and then there's another wave, and it's this time it's natural. It's a fire that came down and burned up all the sheep, and then another wave, and another enemy, the Chaldeans, and they've come down, and they've destroyed the camels. No, not the camels, right? Like, and then finally, unfathomable, right? This last wave, this wind that blows in and destroys this home where all of his children, all 10 of his kids, are killed in a moment. You know, in kind of our day and age, when we kind of live in this therapeutic world, we would call this, these waves, we would call this someone having to deal with complex layers of grief. I mean, can you imagine that moment? I mean, you've lost everything, your wealth, your future, your family, your legacy. And think about your response. Job's response is, "May the name of the Lord be praised." And I'll just ask you for a moment, is that your response? I had to ask myself that this week. I mean, is that ever my response, right? I mean, in those moments, they're just so difficult to know in these challenges. And I see it all the time, and I face it in my own life, in these challenges. What will you do with your relationship with God? I got to tell you, this morning has been kind of a hard morning. In fact, in our home, we've been in kind of a valley. My wife's mom passed away just this morning, and she's been dealing with kind of a really long stretch of cancer and Alzheimer's, and she went to be with the Lord this morning, and we were celebrating her life and the fact that she is no longer in pain. But it's a valley of challenge, for especially for my wife and her family, and just seeing them go through that. I've got so many great memories with my in-laws and my mother-in-law especially, that, you know, it hurts here for us to lose someone that's just such a beautiful, wonderful person. But yet, these are the valleys that we all have to navigate. In fact, Sean and I, this isn't, you know, the first time we've dealt with this. My mom's passed away. Sean and I both also actually lost our closest friends at a very young age. We both lost our best friends. Sean lost her best friend in our 30s due to a really freak snowmobile accident, and we were just with them like the night before, and then she was gone. And then my best friend, my fishing buddy, my running buddy, my biking buddy, and like everything we did together, and we were camping, and he had a massive heart attack and died literally right with us. And I'll tell you, we've seen that, and we've experienced that, and we've also had to kind of witness our friends become widowed at very young age. And it's just so hard to see them go through that. And we've got great, great network, great people around us. We are so loved and we are so grateful for that. But we've had to see our friends make this decision as well, that in the face of suffering, am I going to cling to God, or is this going to be the moment where I push God away? And that's the choice that we all have to make in those moments. We've been fortunate to see just our friends really choose to draw closer to God, and we've seen them experience so much comfort. I think comfort that you can't experience apart from that type of loss. But every single one of us faces those moments. And I got to tell you, that's why I want you to read this whole book, because this is day one for Job. And it gets much worse the next day. In fact, Satan is not happy with Job's response, and so he takes it up a notch, and in the next wave of attacks, the next wave of suffering, he does attack the man, Job, and his body is inflicted with all these boils, the text tells us, and I mean, his health is destroyed. In fact, his friends show up to visit him, and the boils are so severe that his friends cannot even recognize Job. He's so disfigured, and when they finally recognize him, they tear their clothes, and they start weeping, and they really, it's a beautiful moment. These three friends sit with Job, and they comfort him, and then that's where the book kind of gets long and drawn out, because there's something that shifts in these friends, and they go from comforting to Job to actually kind of blaming Job. Like, Job, what did you do to deserve all this? Like, you're a mess. And they're implying in their ongoing conversation, it's like the more they say, the more they kind of put their foot in their mouth, and they begin to imply, Job, all of this is your fault. And then Mrs. Job chimes in, and I wanted you to read this because Mrs. Job has gone through a lot. She's lost a lot, and she's hurting as well. And in a marriage, if one is hurting, they're both hurting. But I wanted you to see this exchange between Job and his wife in chapter 2, verse 9. In fact, it says, his wife said to him, "Are you still maintaining your integrity?" Like, that is the choice. That is the choice we have to make. "Curse God and die." Job replied, "You are talking like a foolish woman. Shall we accept good from God and not trouble?" Now, aside from the obvious, which is Mr. and Mrs. Job could use a little bit of counseling, right? I mean, they could use a little weekend to remember. They could, you know, kind of need a little comfort and a little love for this couple. But I think herein lies kind of the question that we have as well. Is you go through suffering and you're really left with two choices. I mean, you have Mrs. Job here who says, "Curse God, it's God's fault." Or you have Job's friends, you have people around you that when things are tough, they say to you unhelpful things that imply it's your fault. And herein lies the two choices that the world gives us. In seasons of suffering, you will be told that you either have to hate God, reject God, blame God, or hate yourself, blame yourself, take it all on yourself. Those are the two options that the world gives. And the only other alternative is the one that Job chooses, which is to let God be God. And as hard as this is, he learns this lesson of who's actually in control. Maybe an easier way to say this is you will suffer in life. And you can choose to suffer with God or without God. Now, again, read the rest of this book, because what's so interesting about this story is God actually shows up at the end of the book, and he shows up in the life of Job. And I'm not saying it always turns out this way, but God comes to Job, and he starts asking Job all of these really pointed questions. In fact, when God shows up, you expect God to say, "Oh, come here, Job, give me a big hug, crawl up on my lap." And God is not like that. God is not all lavender and lilacs. He's not like that. In fact, God asked Job all these questions. He says things to Job like, "Where were you when I laid the earth's foundation? Were you there when the first fawn took its breath? How about when the Leviathan surfaced and then went back down into the deep?" All these questions, and these are questions that Job cannot answer because he's finite. And these are questions, one scholar said, these are questions that are leading Job down a path that he should have known all along, that his life is an illusion of control and that God has ultimately always been there, always with him. We read at the end of the story, God actually restores Job's life. I'm not saying it always works out this way. It's not a formula, but we read that the second half of Job's life was actually blessed more than the first, which means he has more camel and more ox and more servants. And he and Mrs. Job work things out, and they have 10 more kids. And it's kind of crazy, but I think it shows us the goodness of God, even in the face of suffering. So really just one thought. How do we suffer? How do we face trouble? How do we go through the valleys of life together? I've had this privilege as a pastor to see the front row of life and have a seat on not only my own pain and suffering in life, but yours as well. And I would just simply say, as your pastor, just one thought, maybe one thing to consider is when you're going through suffering, you need to learn to balance your tears with the truth. And I mean that in all love, because you will suffer and you will find yourself hurting and you will do what every human being does. You will try to self-protect and it won't work. You will still hurt. You will still feel the pain and it will be very acute and you will be overwhelmed. You will have tears, and I don't want you at all to push that aside. That's a natural part of grief and life. And at the same time, as your pastor, though, I want to tell you that in those moments of tears, you need to balance that with the truth of God. The truth of God all along for Job is that God was always with them. And in your hurt and in your pain, God is still there. You know what's so fascinating? I mean, this blows me away of the whole story. You know, Job gets through this life. And what's so strange is God, he never tells him about this conversation that he had in heaven with Satan. You know, that never makes it into the fabric of discussion. And I think, again, it just shows us how God is in control. And we can choose to trust him with our lives because God knows our lives. God looks down at Job. He's blameless. He's upright, and God knows that. And that's the challenge and the opportunity we have to step into. I wanted to remind you of just one truth as we close and as the team leads us this morning. And it's just simply the truth that nothing can separate you from the love of God. No matter what you have gone through, no matter what you have done, no matter what you think you have done, nothing can separate you from the love of God. And I don't know who needs to hear that this morning, but I know that that's the truth that the enemy would love to take away from you, that there's somehow some way in which you could be removed from the love of God. And these aren't my words. These are actually the words straight out of Romans 8. And it's this beautiful line of kind of the writer here asking, what can separate us from the love of God? Can trouble or hardship or famine or nakedness, could height nor depth nor angels nor demons? And the resounding response is no, nothing can separate you from the love of God. My hope and my prayer this morning is that you would know and you would cling to the love of God in this moment, in every moment, but especially in the moments where you find yourself in a valley. If you would bow your head, if you would pray with me, please. God, life's not easy, and life doesn't have simple answers. But there's this reminder that we have this way that we're called to walk. And it's the way of following you with all of our heart and all of our soul and all of our strength. And God, I just pray for my friends, the people that are here and online today, that we would know that in a real and authentic way. That when the valleys come, that we would walk through them together. And that we would cling to you with all that we've got. God, I just pray a special prayer over every person here that they would know that nothing can separate them from your love. You are loved this morning. You are cherished. You are blessed. And you have the opportunity to walk with God from this moment forward. God, we praise you and we thank you and we give you all the glory. And it's your name we pray. Amen.
Thanks for listening to our podcast today. Check out our app or website at bridgewaycommunity.org for more messages or to take the sermon one step deeper by downloading the sermon discussion guide.